Welcome to Managing Uncertainty, a podcast series from the experts at BrightPath discussing global risk, business continuity, and crisis management. Will you be ready to lead your organization through its critical moment?
Welcome to the Managing Uncertainty podcast. And we have, this is our first three-person podcast, and we have one of our employees with us, Lindsay Bradford.
Hi, everyone.
So, Lindsay, tell us a little bit about you.
Sure. So I am up here visiting BrightPath. I met Jen and Brian when I worked for Target at the Corporate Command Center, where I learned all of my crisis management background. Before that, I was in investigations with Target. And before that, I was with Tempe PD Police Department out in Arizona as a tactical crime analyst. So I focused on homicide and cold case sex crimes. So I have a little bit of a unique background. Husband is in the Navy. He's on one of the new ships. So that brought us down to Jacksonville, Florida, where we currently reside. I've bounced back and forth across the country now two and a half times in the last 3 years. So it's been exciting, and I'm back to be excited to be back here with the crew again.
We're excited to have you.
Our long-term goal here at BrightPath, of course, is to get the band back together, literally. And we're well on our way to doing that. We're adding our fifth person here in a couple of weeks. We'll have her on the podcast as well.
Which will be really fun.
Which is going to be really fun. But we're here today to talk about something else entirely, absolutely, which is leading through active shooter situations. And Jen, Lindsay, and I, when we worked together at our previous employer, had the unfortunate experience of leading through multiple active shooter situations. I think it was seven for me, one of which was an actual full-blown kind of response, the way we think of like people sheltering in place and having to go through a building with a SWAT team and lots of folks in harm's way. And that turned out to be a false alarm.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness. Yes. We were really worried about a number of people in that situation. But we also worked through a number of homicides involving employees and customers and others from a lot of different situations. So we're going to talk about what that looks like and what we learned through that process, which we're happy to share with you so that you can be prepared. But we certainly hope that you never have to use any of this in your career.
Yeah. So first, just briefly, when you're talking about active shooter, you have to start with before the attack. So with an active shooter, there's never just one incident. There's always pre-attack indicators of some kind, whether it be an employee or a guest at a organization, or it could be domestic violence that spills over into the workforce. But either way, there's always some kind of pre-attack behavior.
We have one client today that almost every actual violent threat, real threat that has come in, as opposed to, you know, threatening comments and things that aren't actually threats, the real threats have been entirely domestic violence situations. In the incident, this client has two very large campuses, corporate campuses in a large urban area in the western part of the United States. The ones that have actually occurred as violent incidents at their facilities have been domestic situations that have spilled over into the workplace.
Right. So first and foremost, it's about recognizing what those indicators are so you can hopefully stop it before it happens, right?
So we deal with that. What are some of those pre-attack indicators that are out there in these situations?
So the number one indicator is an actual verbal threat or a written threat, some kind of specific threat made is really a number one indicator. So that can often be done, domestic violence, threatening their intimate partner. Or it could be an employee on employee making a threat, an actual threat. So those are big ones. Other indicators can be a change in behavior at work. So if you have an employee who's been really an awesome employee, and all of a sudden their performance starts to decline, that might be an indicator and something you want to maybe just talk to them about and see what's going on.
And a big part of this not only is seeing the indicators, but having some kind of threat management process so that threats are reported centrally and there's a method by which they're evaluated, triaged to what's real.
Right. So in my previous role, I actually worked on one of those teams where we evaluated threats of violence and we put them into different risk categories to determine what to do next. So how do you mitigate those situations? So that's what I did in this previous role.
I actually used Jen's services in one of these situations. Once we departed ways were in different areas of the business, I had to call because, like Jen had mentioned, the interactions and the behaviors of the employee changed significantly to a point where it wasn't just management, it was the team was noticing these things, and it really was a very large indicator. So they had never verbally said something to us, but there were a lot of things that were starting to make people uncomfortable and we were noticing. So I had to call Jen to work through next steps and what could possibly happen. So I think knowing your team is really important and being okay saying something's wrong, something's different now, like listening to your gut.
Right. And there's no one indicator either. There's no one indicator that's going to point to active shooter, but that's why it's important to evaluate the whole situation and slow down in the process to really understand what's going on. So leading into that, then you go into what do you do with that information? How do you prepare yourself for a violent threat or a full-blown active shooter?
So we often have folks that call, and we talked with some people at a conference we were at this week who kind of started the conversation with, yeah, I'd like to talk to you about building an active shooter plan. And we always turn that around to, before we even get to the plan, how do you handle crises today? Like, what's the process by which you collaborate and make decisions and communicate the results of those decisions? And so we always go back to what we've talked about in previous podcasts, which is you need some kind of framework. You need a crisis team. You need a collaborative process where you're able to talk through these situations and make decisions. You need a way to escalate these situations to your executives or to your board if that's appropriate. But you have to start there, because if you just start with, I got to have a plan,
right,
and you get a situation that doesn't fit your plan, you've got nowhere to go.
And a single source reporting, right? So how do you get the information to that framework so that they can make decisions from there?
Right. So we start with having a crisis framework and having a crisis team. And a theme that we keep coming back to is picking the right people for that crisis team. We want folks who are going to be calm in the moment and can deal with the emotional impact of some of these situations, natural disasters, active shooter. I mean, active shooter is about the most traumatic thing I think you can go through. But
right. And it truly happens a very small percentage of the time. Most of the time, it's other incidents that don't quite get to the active shooter level.
Right. So then we talk about having a plan. And I know in the past there's been lots of discussion about what should be in a plan, what should we tell people to do. But the last couple of years, I think that's really kind of, we've really come down to there's consensus on what should be done. And what is that? It's run, hide, fight, right?
Yeah, that's the common thing you see all over the place, right? You see it in airports, you see it in schools. The DHS, run, hide, fight, seems to be really common. Everyone recognizes it and knows it at this point, I think, or most people do at this point. So it's just understanding what those steps are and what you're communicating out to your teams.
Right. And that's simple, right? Because if you're in a stressful situation, extremely high stressful situation, you need simplicity. If you have all these little intricate steps, that's not going to work at the end of the day for people that aren't trained and have that type of mindset. So I love the run, hide, fight, simplistic steps we have.
Right. So run. So you can get away.
If I can get away, I'm going to get out.
Yes.
I'm going to get far away.
Don't question it. Just leave.
Don't take anything.
Nope.
Just go.
Don't go back in either. You stay out.
That's a great point.
Get out.
Leave your cell phone. Leave your keys. Leave everything. Just get out of the area. Yep.
Hide. I'm going to shelter in place. I'm going to find a room I can lock. A bathroom, a conference room, an office. One that doesn't have windows or that has blinds that can cover the windows.
Right.
And this poses an interesting challenge for the workplace in that we're used to not putting locks on conference rooms and bathrooms and, you know, maybe even some
schools
offices.
And,
schools are a great example. But now lots of companies are going back and adding locks and blinds and things back in because you need to be able to shelter in place and you need to be able to create that barrier of entry in these situations.
Right. And you might have to get creative too. So it may not be a conference room that you hide in, but you're able to get into a cabinet or something like that.
Right.
Something to get yourself out of sight so that you're not visible for the shooter.
And then fight. If you're confronted and you're comfortable doing so, then fight with what you have. You can distract them with a stapler, with a phone, with a podcast microphone.
Yep.
I mean, what can you use?
I mean, even loud noises, and I think you might know from some of your training, like just loud, quick noises if there's, for some reason, nothing in that room can distract them or catch them off guard. And
if you can quickly organize.
Yep.
And a couple of you can attack at the same time, that'll throw them off guard as well.
All great ideas. So we think about this for frontline employees, that keeping it that simple. You know, your warehouses, your retail stores, your factories. We're not asking them to make decisions and establish command and control, but their messages look, run, hide, fight, call 911. If you got an internal reporting number, crisis center, or whatever, then make that call. Otherwise, get away. And that's what we really encourage companies to keep the plan that simple. If you hand a warehouse manager a 180-page active shooter plan, who's going to execute that?
Right, because here's the deal. Once it gets to that point, we know these situations end within a matter of minutes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot of time to do anything else. So that simplicity that you said, Lindsay, is a good means of explaining it.
At a corporate level, it's a different kind of plan. I mean, for your employees, of course, in a headquarters environment, you're going to have run, hide, fight, and that's what you want people to do.
Yeah, so you're going to have a checklist. So your first steps in for your crisis team is you're going to have a checklist. So this gets reported in to your crisis team. The people answering the phones are the first person that's going to be responding, right? So they're going to have a checklist of questions you need. Understand what it is that law enforcement is going to need from you.
And what are those initial actions
that you're
going to
take? So have a plan. Have it readily accessible so that person that's answering the phone is prepared to ask the questions quickly, just like a 911 dispatcher would.
Right. They're going to pull a process and they're going to execute that process.
Which ties right back to the framework, which you brought up earlier, that you absolutely need. This initial step and all these checklists and questions will then lead you to go through that framework and the next steps.
So we're going to, when you have these plans in place, then the really important part comes in, which is, plans are plans, but if you don't exercise them, they don't mean anything. So you have to practice. You have to exercise all aspects of this. You have to exercise what run, hide, fight means. Mm-hmm. Don't have your employees fight each other, but you know. Do they know what to do? Do they know how to evacuate? Do they know where to take shelter? And for your corporate team, your crisis team, you should run tabletop exercises or simulated exercises for them to kind of work through their crisis action plan.
Right. And one thing we've been asked in the past is, how do you actually simulate that stressful environment? If it's a tabletop or an exercise, they know it's a tabletop or exercise. Well, you know, obviously in the military, we exercise a lot, but you can compound those stressors to make it as realistic as possible.
Right.
So maybe you have an active shooter in the exercise, but you throw in another area of the country where you also do business, there's also a hurricane going on. So they have to force them to manage all of these different situations to simulate that added stress.
And I also think you can do, I know we did it a few times where we didn't tell the full team that we were having an exercise. So that's how we did internal assessments, as well as how our personal team reacted and how we went through that, is we didn't tell our team that we were going to do it. There were a couple people that knew, and then we executed the event and really helped for lessons learned. It's a great way to practice.
You might want to make sure your leaders know what you're doing.
Yes.
Exercise, exercise, exercise. Put headers on those emails so you don't freak people out. One other area of preparedness is that you really need to sit down with your local law enforcement agency and have this discussion about what your plan calls for, and learn what their plan calls for, and make them familiar with invite them in to look at your facility and understand the layouts and points of entry and places that they could use so they might gain an advantage in one of these situations.
Yeah, and one thing at our previous employers, they would come in and actually welcome that, because they'll come in and do their own exercises and we can go along for the ride.
Right.
Yes, they're open to. I just read an article this morning, like North Carolina, one of these schools worked with law enforcement to do that. So they're very open to it.
Our clients out on the west, in the western part of the U.S., for the two headquarters campuses, the two city police departments have come in and done extensive photos and videos of how to get in and where to go and, you know, how they can approach the buildings and, you know, what's behind door number 8? Is that a good place to enter? I mean, lots of discussions about things that they could do because of the risk with this particular client of ours.
Yep. And understanding backup plans. Well, that original plan didn't work. What else can we do? So being nimble in the time.
So the bad thing happens. We have the active shooter, we have the violent situation. Where do we start?
Well, I think it goes back to the framework again. So you have that single source reporting, comes into whoever you, however you got it set up, someone that's going to come in and gather this information, and they're going to start asking questions to try to validate what's going on.
So you're
going to
run the checklist.
Run down the checklist.
You're going to write down that checklist of questions that you've prepared on what you should ask. And while your local facility is executing Run, Hide, Fight and the steps that you've outlined for them, because you've written this plan down, right? And you've exercised it with the team so they know what to do.
So we were all actually in an incident at our previous employer where this had happened. Like Brian had originally said that it was a false alarm, but we all went right to it. We started following. We had someone who was in charge, and then the rest of us followed and did what we needed to do. And then when there were people in the room that needed to not be in the room, we made sure to boot them out so that we could actually do the business at hand.
We in this particular situation, we should be clear that it actually took 4 hours before we knew that it was a false alarm, and it went on for quite a while.
Right. And I think, just to make a side note, I think that's important to know is that sometimes you won't know all the answers, and it took four hours for us to find out what actually was the cause of the noise and everything that happened. And so when you're beginning to execute this plan and that initial call comes in, you may not get all the details. Your questions are not going to be they will not be detailed. You won't know everything, and that's okay. And you guys have to be comfortable with that as well. And so that's why the checklist helps you walk through all of that.
And we had in that situation, to Jennifer's point, we had some people come in and decide to be a part of the crisis process that weren't. And we invited them to leave and go meet with the representatives from their organizations that were involved in the crisis process, because it was just disruptive. But this is going to happen. I mean, you have the high profile major thing, and you're going to have some senior leaders that think they're supposed to be involved when hopefully you have a well-defined crisis process.
Right. In our case, one thing I do think that we did really well in this situation is that we had an on-call process. So that on-call person was the lead in this situation. And I think that works really well because it's clear. Everybody knows exactly who to talk to, who to give updates to. And that person, well, for lack of a better word, can start barking orders and the rest of us can follow.
Absolutely. And they don't have to be the most senior person in the room. And I think that's what also worked, is that we knew we respected the position. We respected the framework and our process. And that person was not the most senior. I think Brian said she was one of the least experienced, but still ran it. And we all fell in place. And that helps with that communication piece as well. You don't have multiple people running the show, and everything was very clear and concise, and we were able to execute properly.
Yep. And there's plenty of things to do in that situation.
Yes.
Plenty
yes.
of things to do. So to include is as easy as taking care of basic needs. So we had one person that was ordering food for the whole group because we knew we were in for the long haul.
Very important.
People are going to get hungry. It's an adrenaline driven situation. You're going to need caffeine. Mm-hmm. I mean, I recall drinking coffee like a fiend throughout this whole situation.
Yes.
Just because that's what I felt I needed to stay kind of perky.
And Code Red Mountain Dew. That was very important that day for us as well. Yep.
So the other thing about taking care of basic needs was we had all of our technicians, the ones answering the phone and fielding all these calls that were coming in.
Call home.
Take a moment and call home. Take some time away and go make sure that their families know that they were not, in fact, in that building.
Yeah, we should give context that this happened in a headquarters complex where our command center was in one building and the incident was actually occurring across the street from where we were sitting.
Yeah, so we were perfectly safe.
We were fine. We were just really worried about people that were in the building. Right. And this actually brings up an interesting point with your crisis team, in that you have to have multiple backups for positions. One of the key players in our crisis team in this situation was actually in the building that the threat was in and was holed up in an office with many other people sheltering in place. But he couldn't come to the command center, obviously, to participate in the discussion and response. So his backup went, who was his boss. And, you know, there's good connectivity there. But that was part of the plan. Like, he was going to be the backup if the primary wasn't available. And we had practiced that. So they knew how to execute and do it. So we're back to that. You have to practice the things that you put into place around that.
And then one other thing that I think is also important to note is, and I had sort of alluded to it earlier with the exercising, but you may have other things going on besides just this incident. So you may have multiple things that you need to manage at one time. And so it may be important to select a different space for all of that other stuff and assign different people for all that other stuff.
Right. Your business is still operating outside of this one location where the incident's at. So you still do need to have that focus in one way or another.
So it may seem like time has stopped and this is the most important thing. There may be other things that you needed to manage at the same time. So finding a different conference room for something like that mm-hmm. to go on might be a good idea.
So one of the other areas that we've learned coming out of this and having managed multiple situations is that in today's world where everything moves at the speed of light when it comes to reputation and social media and what gets on the news, is that your communications planning is just as important as your response planning. And it actually needs to be integrated into that process. But we often run into challenges as consultants where we talk with comms teams about the need to develop messaging templates and themes and how are you going to respond in the moment. And the answer we get most often is, well, every situation is unique. Therefore, we're going to build the plan after the incident happens so that we can put all the right context in there. And we say, no, that's a bad idea.
That's a really bad idea.
There's no time.
Right.
There is no time to do that.
Well, not only is there no time, but it's stressful.
Right.
So why would you put yourself into a situation that's even more stressful when you could just have something pre-drafted?
Well, and what if the comms team is inoperable? What if they're in that location and even the backup of the backup of the backup isn't there? Someone else needs to be able to step in and execute that. So if you have these templates, your crisis team, someone else can step in and help initiate that communication and those messages.
Yeah. You can edit the pre-prepared messages before they go out.
Right.
They don't change all that much.
Absolutely. Especially from a brand reputation perspective, you're going to be using the same type of messaging.
When these situations happen, particularly if they're close geographically to your headquarters, we always encourage, and we did in this situation, sending a comms staff member, communications staff member, along with a senior executive who hopefully will have been trained in speaking publicly, down to wherever the law enforcement public information officer, the PIO is, so that they can coordinate and make sure they're dealing with the same set of information. But it's best if they talk to the press together, because as a company, you're not going to want to talk about the law enforcement details of what's going on. You are, in fact, not going to want to share a lot about the incident until well after it's over. But it shows unity and it keeps you on the same page about what's going on.
And it should be consistent. All of the communicating should be consistent.
Right. Communication technologies also come into play, mass notification tools. In our particular situation here, we didn't have anything like that.
There was a loudspeaker.
We had a loudspeaker. We were using radios and cell phones to communicate. We were using runners in some cases to run down between the command post the police has set up and our command center because we were having some communication difficulties.
Which is common. I mean, we have heard from other people in different situations where cell phones may not work in certain situations, so you have to come up with a backup plan. Mm-hmm.
And then like any crisis, when this is over, an honest self-assessment is really needed about what worked and what didn't, and what do you want to take away from that in terms of action items. If your employees are involved, they're going to have thoughts, and you're going to need to find a way to capture that. Survey, listening session. And then for your employees as well, you need to circle back with them about what you've decided to do. Like, here are the things that I learned that I want to bring back to the team and say, here's what we're doing in response to your concerns. Because otherwise, they're going to think you're not doing anything. And so you need to communicate those things.
Yep. Even if you're not saying a lot, saying something's better than nothing.
Acknowledging
to your
them.
Employees, for sure.
Well, and I think the key is an honest recap and assessment of what happened. So if something were to actually happen, whether that be if you're just going through the exercise and then the actual event happens, like, you need to know where the gaps were. You can't just pretend so your team looks great that, wow, this is fabulous. And then an actual event happens and you see these huge gaps that everyone knew was there but didn't want to talk about, so they didn't look bad in front of the executive. So you really, truly, because this could be people's lives on the line at this point, have that.
It's not the time to be proud.
Exactly. Best way to say it.
So closing thoughts, and then I'll wrap up. You've heard a number of our lessons learned about dealing and leading in an active shooter situation. If we can help you with your active shooter planning, or you want to talk about crisis frameworks or crisis communications or some of the topics here, give us a call. Our number is 612-235-6435, or contact us through our website at brightpath.com. And we'd be happy to talk with you about your particular needs and how we can help you. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Managing Uncertainty, produced by the experts at BrightPath. To receive notifications of new episodes, join our newsletter at brightpath.com or subscribe to your favorite podcast player, such as iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about the services and trusted advice from BrightPath by visiting brightpath.com. That's BrightPath.com.